We start today with what I think is a real treat. Professor Doug Seifelt of the UNL History Department will talk today. He's going to talk about William Cody or Buffalo Bill. Professor Seifelt is assistant professor in the UNL History Department and also a faculty fellow and one of the intellectual leaders in our celebrated Center for Digital Research in the Humanities. He is the senior digital editor for a big project to digitize the papers of William Cody, which is a multi-scholar and multi-state effort. He's the co-editor of the book series from that project, one of the first volume of which is this 4 Years in Europe with Buffalo Bill. And the second book, I understand just out or recently out, is this major biography, The Life of the Honorable William F. Cody, known as Buffalo Bill. Doug's published work focuses on the intersections of landscape and memory in the American West. One of his projects, for example, which takes both digital and print form, is called Horrible Massacre of Emigrants! The Mountain Meadows Massacre in Public Discourse. His talk today is Buffalo Bill's Great Plains, 1846 to 1879.
But before I get too far into this, I want to say thank you to several people. So if you'll bear with me. The Buffalo Bill Historical Center, a partner in this project, as Rick said, the Papers of William F. Cody project originates out of the McCracken Research Library there in Cody. It's actually now an international venture, or I was going to say adventure, where we have partner institution at the University of Strathclyde in Scotland and associate editors working on Buffalo Bill in Germany, Buffalo Bill in Italy, France, and Spain. So actually the first book in the second series we co-edit out of Nebraska Press, the Cody Studies series, a monograph series, will be Chris Dixon's study of Buffalo Bill in Barcelona. So Jeremy Johnston, Frank Christensen, and Linda Clark at the BBHC have been very supportive of this endeavor. Here at the Center for Great Plains Studies, I'd be remiss without acknowledging Jim Stubendick and Gretchen Walker, who have helped us get this thing off the ground, especially this Buffalo Bill's Great Plains digital project. The Plains Studies Alliance, Tim Mahoney and Wendy Katz, former and current directors of that project. We are a PHA project, as far as the stuff I'm going to show you today on Buffalo Bill's Great Plains, so I thank them. At the Center for Digital Research in the Humanities, Kay Walter, Laura Weekly, Karen Dalzell, and Keith Nickum, as well as Brent Baum, who designed our web presence for the Great Plains project, and Rob Shepard, who's helping us with the mapping, geo-referencing of the GIS material. The Cody Archive, project manager Jason Hepler, UCARE student I'm working with this year, Jared Rorick, has created a spatial chronology data set that I'll show you today, and some graduate research assistants in the history department, Brent Rogers, who left us for a job, which is everything we hope for from our advisees, and I won't call her his replacement because Casey Nash has brought so much to this project, and she's continuing to work with me on this today. So this is not just me. There's a lot of people involved in this, and this is one of the hallmarks of digital research in the humanities. It's not just that model of a lone wolf scholar off in some dusty, musty archive coming up for air every once in a while and publishing a book and to great kudos and things like that. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of effort and things that go into this. So I want to, before we jump into this, I want to show you just a couple of these things. And at the end, you'll get the URLs, so don't worry about trying to write these down right now unless you're into that kind of thing. This is the Cody Archive. This is something that would be analogous to the papers of Thomas Jefferson or something like that, except it's William Cody. We picked this image because we think of Cody in multiple ways, not just in his public persona as Buffalo Bill, but the things that he did, not just in the mythic West, let's say, but also in the modern West as a town builder and things like that. So if you go to the site right now, you will find the material as we edit it. Steve Witte, who is here at the Center for Great Plains Studies, is annotating much of the Cody correspondence. And so as we get material, it goes through a process, it gets put up here for people to use, for researchers. We're doing some thematic-oriented approaches to the material, but we're also kicking out scholarship. We're connecting to the community, and we hope to make this a 21st century papers project that, you know, perhaps it will spin off thematic letterpress editions, but it's not going to be the soup to nuts, birth to death, march, one volume a year that we're kind of used to in that model. A lot has changed since the days of yore. Some funding to the history department from the Buffalo Bill Historical Center has allowed me to work with some very talented graduate students on something we call the Buffalo Bill Project, where we are doing some digital research, born digital scholarship that is using some of the archive material. It's actually finding a lot of material that gets into the archive. These are projects that we plan to have published in digital format with journals, history journals. So our first two here, Buffalo Bill's Wild West and the Progressive Image of American Indians and the Rough Riders and Manly Image projects, are going to be sent off pretty soon to the Journal of the Gilded Age and Progressive Era. The project that I'm here to really focus on today is Buffalo Bill's Great Plains. And this is a project that has enjoyed funding from the Nebraska, the Kansas, and the Iowa Humanities Councils, and have generously supported what will be this three-state project that is, as I'll explain today, is trying to understand more about the early years of Cody, that right now we just have the autobiography to work from, mostly. So I should say that the autobiography that Rick pointed out is recently published by Frank Christensen, our senior digital editor of the Papers Project. This is the first fully annotated edition of Cody's 1879 autobiography. So it updates Don Russell's book from Nebraska Press from the 1970s. The image you have in front of you here, I know it's really hard to see if you're in the back, but this is the end papers of a book from 1955 on Buffalo Bill. And I just want to show you this so you can see from that perspective, on the tipping point of the mid-century of the last century, we see Cody and his Wild West depicted in a very familiar cartoon style here on the map of North America. There he is on the statue, the famous statue outside the Buffalo Bill Historical Center in Cody, on the top left. But we see scenes from his amazing life as presented through the persona Buffalo Bill, from railroads and Pony Express over here. I'm going to use this arm. We got stagecoaches and Native American people hunting bison, kind of behind my name there. Civil War activities. There he is meeting with presidents in Washington. That's Teddy Roosevelt, I think. All kinds of activities. And then up across the very top is the Wild West exhibition moving across America behind the flag. That's when it's Maine or something like that. So we see some of those large images of Cody as a celebrity, as someone bigger than life, and perhaps dare I say, sort of the authenticity can be questioned of to some of the activities he claimed to have been part of. The Pony Express is probably the one that most people point to, questioning his actual involvement. So it's important for us to figure out who is Buffalo Bill anyway. I think this is a rhetorical strategy that'll pay great dividends as we try to frame the activities on the plains that helped shape him, and I contend that he then comes out the other end and helps shape the national mind and their attitudes toward this region. So we can just run through a few of these quotations from people who have spent a great amount of time studying and writing significantly on Cody. So Don Russell, probably the, I would say, the preeminent 20th century biographer, actually in his 1960 book, says that Cody was the man of many lives and legends, the all-around champion in popular opinion, publicity opinion, if you will, was Buffalo Bill. He says, you need name no other. And in the introduction to his edition, or the introduction to the reprinted edition of the Bison book series of the autobiography, he says, Cody was an authentic hero. You can read this here, in the terms of his period. But writing from the period that we find ourselves in the late 20th century, this age of cynicism, he seems to be far more important as a showman, someone who's manipulating an image. And we're a little bit more, we might be suspicious of our heroes, for sure, but we're really suspicious of showmen, I would think, and those who are out there playing with fast and loose with the past. And Nellie Snyder Yost, she's, you may know, a resident of North Platte, or was a resident of North Platte, and she really attempts in her book to get at the real William F. Cody, who settled in that town, who, while he traveled all over, he brought back and spent money in that community, and was a good neighbor, if you will. And she says that he's a unique, he's a big, picturesque personality without precedent, without successor. So we're starting to get this idea of him as a unique one-off. Joy Kasson, who's, I think, terrific book on, she's an American Studies scholar, to place Cody and the Wild West exhibition into the popular memory and celebrity, claims that he was the most famous American of his time, and only Theodore Roosevelt, she claims, was equally charismatic as an American action hero, of course, known to millions. The scholar who most recently studied Cody to great success is Louis Warren, of course. His prize-winning book, Buffalo Bill's America, won this institution's book prize. And he observes that Cody represents some unification, some coming together of the old and the new, whether that's the old West and the new West, the old America, the new America. Obviously, there's other dichotomies here that he's looking at. He becomes the nation's brightest star. So this is a pretty high platform he's being set up upon here. He goes on to say that for generations of Americans and Europeans, Buffalo Bill defined the meaning of American history and American identity. So this young Willie from Iowa becomes the standard bearer for a nation that's seeking, as it always had, for centuries, to identify itself, to lay claim to something particular and special. And they found in that William Cody and what he represented and the place, and I argue that he came from. So as some of these ideas that we have, authentic hero, showman, a good neighbor, an action hero, all of these things are in play. So who is he really? Mark Ellis, writing for the Encyclopedia of the Great Plains, wants us to have it both ways. He says, probably a prudent thing, he says he's both a real frontier hero, okay, we can acknowledge that, who participated in the conquest of the American West, and a Western showman who promoted and perpetuated the winning of the West in romantic terms, something that he definitely, if he didn't invent, he certainly fostered and encouraged to grow through other media over time. So to get to an assessment, then, of Cody as showman, a scholar's foreground, the larger-than-life cultural hero that is Buffalo Bill, or was Buffalo Bill, and often we background the real experiences of William F. Cody, or, as Don Russell noted, Billy to his childhood acquaintances, Will or Uncle Will to the members of his family, Mr. Cody to the army men of his scouting days, and the Colonel to associates from his show career. But working with the repository of materials collected by the Buffalo Bill Historical Center and held at the McCracken Research Library at the museum in building this Cody William F. Cody archive project, we became immediately aware that even as we combed through the more than 545 linear feet of related manuscript materials, from dime novels and correspondence to posters, photographs, film, even audio recordings, that there was a distinct lack of material sources for the early years of Cody's life. What we had is this autobiography that many people question if he even wrote it, although Russell adamantly says, puts that to rest by saying that he did. And Christensen, in his introduction to the new edition, basically claims that Cody was aping a genre that was popular at the time, and he was following those literary conventions to the best of his ability, writing, of course, from memory without notes, leaving lots of opportunity for error to creep in, including the own year of his birth, off by a year. But these years of his life, these early years, from his birth and early childhood in Iowa in the 1840s through the early 1850s, to his formative years in Kansas from 52 to 68 or so, and his young adult period in Nebraska following that, up to the publication of the autobiography, are crucial to our understanding of this man who would go on to national and international celebrity. To help us understand the relationship of the Great Plains to his personal experiences and values, and ultimately to the things that he took away from his time here on the plains and incorporated first into his stage show and then into the Wild West exhibitions. So this project, Buffalo Bill's Great Plains, seeks to fill in those gaps in Cody's biography where the paper trail ends, by researching and interpreting similar experiences and activities in these specific places and time that can help shed light on people like Cody, if not Cody himself, and activities like the ones he participated in, if not the exact activity, to try to contextualize and understand a little bit better that world of Cody that Cody experienced. I want to spend a few minutes talking about sort of the evolution of William F. Cody into Buffalo Bill. And what you see here is a family tree of sorts that gives a great depiction of his relationship to his ancestors. His grandfather, Philip, was born in 1770 in Oxford, Massachusetts, and grew up on a nearby farm in Charlton, Massachusetts, which was sold when he was 14, necessitating a move to Peru, Massachusetts. And although he didn't live there very long, they moved to central New York, where he eventually married in his mid-20s. Now, it's recorded that he purchased land in Toronto, or in Ontario, Canada, within 10 miles of the town that would eventually become Toronto. 2 years after the land purchase, he sold it. And this is an interesting theme, this land that comes into possession and out of possession really rapidly in this family. He sold this land and built a tavern in Toronto Township. Philip Cody was a surveyor. He bought and sold land, and he served on juries and was appointed constable several times, so he had some respect from the community. Ultimately, he gave his land and had it used to erect a church, and in 1826 moved to Cleveland, Ohio. Why would the family leave Canada after such seeming success in becoming an important part of a new town? Perhaps they wanted the wide-open economic possibilities that America offered, a nation not under an imperial power, as was Canada. In other words, they left to pursue this American dream. So it kind of fits into that larger model. Now, Philip's son, Cody's father, is named Isaac. And Isaac here was born in 1811 in Toronto Township, and he came to Ohio with his family in 1826. Like his father, he worked as a surveyor, and his first wife came from a well-to-do Canadian family, but she died shortly after childbirth. His second wife was from Ohio, and we don't know really what happened to her, although they had a child. They didn't have children. The first one had the one child. His third wife, named Mary Ann, was a school teacher, and in 1839, shortly after they married, Isaac purchased his brother Philip. They recycle the names there. Philip had purchased land just a few months earlier in the Iowa Territory, in Scott County near what would become LeClaire. Philip turned around and sold it to his brother Isaac for double the price. They always say never do business with family members, right? So, but they, the couple moved to Scott County, and like their father, both Isaac and Philip, both Isaac and Philip sold and bought land in sort of a serial fashion. But it's here in Iowa that William Frederick Cody was born on February 26, 1846, where he became the fourth of Isaac's eight children with two wives. And Isaac, during that time, owned, worked and owned and supervised farmlands for other people. He did lots of different jobs, doing some transportation work, having even some mercantile sort of endeavors, before picking up and moving off to Kansas Territory and becoming possibly one of the first white families to settle officially there under law. He dies in 1857 of kidney failure. Now, some of the interesting questions that we're pursuing that we believe will shed some light on William Cody's experiences are, why did the Codys move so often? Was it simply a restless nature? Was it some sort of unfulfilled ambition? Or is it part of a larger pattern that can help us understand more about the population of the Great Plains? In his book, River Towns in the Great West, historian Timothy Mahoney explains this river skip mentality that we see playing out here. This mentality was comprised of several key factors that shape the settlement patterns on the ground. First of all is access to transportation. You have to be on the river or close to the railroad when that would come into play, or some overland route. Economic interests and assets closely tied to transportation. Cultural values, you know, different ethnicities, different people who had different values in this regard. Their goals and intentions. Individuals have different aspirations and are satisfied with different levels of achievement. The quality of the plot of land. They may have made the right decision and put everything all in and just to find out that it was bad soil or in a floodplain or something, you know, you never know. The last of which is luck, Mahoney says. So to examine Isaac Cody's experiences in Ohio initially and then Iowa in this context, and later William F. Cody's experiences in Kansas and Nebraska through this lens, I think is illuminating. Prior to 1830, Mahoney argues, settlers were reluctant to venture into the interior lands, that treeless prairie. But by 1830, settlers began to cross that seeming barrier, and settlement sweeps onto the prairies rapidly. And there's a big boom in the 30s on prairie lands that were accessible to the market by transportation networks, which helps us explain why they went to LeClaire, which is near Davenport. This goes back to Pike and even Long and this whole idea of this Great American Desert being, while showing up on maps, maybe wasn't as influential as we like to think it was, but it was this idea they articulated in their reports about this being a barrier and actually some kind of de facto border, western border for America that they didn't have to worry about because nobody wanted to go out there because it wasn't profitable farmland in the way that they'd envisioned it, treeless and lacked water in some cases, things like that. So there's clearly at least two kinds of frontiersmen in Iowa and Kansas at this time. And then we're looking into different people's journals and things like that to show as counterpoints or contrasts and comparisons to Isaac and William Cody. But we can boil these down to those who were always pushing onward, those who are looking for what's around the next horizon, that next opportunity, to others who are looking to get somewhere and settle down and build a community that they could be a part of. While the others may be looking for that as well, that place to get there first, get the best land, be the mayor, you know, something like that, the others are going to become part of that community and build it up from their residence. So, as we'll see, William Cody, his father Isaac, and even his grandfather Philip before him seem to fit in that first model quite well. So at this point, the transition between Isaac Cody's generation and his sons, we can see and identify what are perhaps two kinds of frontiers. This sort of river, railroad, transportation frontier that Mahoney talks about that enabled the constant movement for that it. You want to make it. You want to achieve it, that the Cody men and many other like them sought after, and that prairie farming frontier that favored those who managed to put down deep roots and rewarded them with that social station that came to characterize making it in these early rural to urban settings in places like Davenport. So as I mentioned earlier, Isaac and Mary Ann Cody left Iowa in June of 1852 and relocated to Kansas Territory and settled around Fort Leavenworth. They lived in Kansas till about 1869. Many of Cody's most formative experiences occurred in Kansas, falling as they did between his 6th birthday and his 23rd. And it's here that William F. Cody transformed himself from a Midwest river frontiersman to a Great Plains Railroad plainsman, a process that he himself was conscious of and noted in his, as he noted his changing outward appearance in his 1879 autobiography. This here is his one of his first influences. When he first came to Kansas with his father in 52, young Billy fortuitously met his cousin, Horace Billings. When his father called to him and said, "Come see what a genuine Western man." Now, in his autobiography, Cody describes Billings as about 6 foot 2 inches tall, well-built, and having a light, springy, and wiry step. He wore a broad-rimmed California hat and was dressed as in a complete suit of buckskin, beautifully trimmed and beaded. And Cody went on to remark, "Everything that he did, I wanted to do." When you think about the younger sibling to a bigger one or something like that. "He was sort of a hero in my eyes," Cody wrote, "and I wished to follow in his footsteps. At my request and with father's consent, he took me with him, and many a wild and perilous chase he led me over the prairie. I made rapid advances in the art of horsemanship, for I could have had no better teacher than Horace Billings. He also taught me how to throw the lasso, which, though it was a difficult thing to learn, I finally became quite skilled in." So Cody, inspired by Horace, begins to take on a Western visage appropriate to his surroundings and modifies it as he, as it seems appropriate, as he participates in a variety of Plains activities. He says, show you some of these. A little arrangement here of some of these images. We can go through, take a look at some of them more directly. This is from actually the stage show that'll come in the 1870s, dressing up as the Plainsmans. These are some curio cabinet cards where he's posing. He knows he's having his picture taken, in other words. Maybe he didn't know it there. I don't know. He's got something on his head. His vaquero-influenced outfit here, very Spanish, very Californio. We're moving through time here from the 70s into the early 80s. I think we're supposed to look this way. When will he ever take my picture? No. Even the details on the gauntlets and whatnot. Starting to be the successful entrepreneur. Very candid shot. I like this one. Not so candid. Signing his life away to Pawnee Bill, I think, in 1905, and here near the end of his life. So these are changes that were real, okay? I think, you know, there can be some overstatement in some of the more recent studies of Cody that he was consciously making himself into some celebrity image. I think it's a little bit tempered in the sense that he was trying to fit into an image that he wanted to portray for the context that he was in. I don't think he really, until maybe it happened, did he ever see himself the way we heard Warren describe him as that leading light of America or the most famous person in the country. You know, he wanted to look right to lead a hunting trip with people he admired. He wanted to play, in some ways, that part, but that, I think, doesn't necessarily suggest or prove that he was doing this on the sly. So there is an evolution here of this sort of thing. Okay, here's the map that we're using for the digital project that will be a geographic interface into the collection of materials and essays and things that we're writing about Buffalo Bill's Great Plains. I think Colton's map here from 1869 is a good one for this period where he's largely concentrated up in here. Sorry, I don't have a pointer. and around where the railroad will Union Pacific will come through. We're going to have little spots on the map that you'll be able to click on, and then it'll take you into that contextual essay with then all the materials behind it. In this period in Kansas, this is when he records in his autobiography friendly interactions with Indians, his father being almost murdered for anti-slavery views in the Bleeding Kansas period. He experiences cattle herding around Fort Leavenworth, a wagon trip to Fort Kearney and back to Grasshopper Falls. He goes up to Wyoming. He gets some schooling. He gets restless and succumbs to gold fever, wants to go to Colorado like many, many people did, goes on trapping expeditions on the Republican near Junction City. He does some Pony Express work, becomes a Jayhawker, delivers military dispatches on horseback, and actually gets into buying horses for the government, joins the 9th Kansas Volunteers as a scout and the Red-Legged Scouts after that. His mother dies. He goes up on a bender, he says, and wakes up to find himself enlisted in the Army. They're in Civil War. He's 1864. He's fighting in Kansas. By 1866, he's working as a stage driver. This is something about Cody. As one of these restless types that's always seeking that opportunity, he was always employed. I mean, the guy was working hard to try to find opportunities. He tries to be a landlord and make money off of renting out rooms and to other people. He kind of gives that up and becomes a scout again, decides he'll make a lot of money if he can become a town builder. That's the thing that his grandfather and his father were all trying to do. So he has the Rome, Kansas debacle that when the railroad decides to go the other direction, they're left high and dry. Then he starts, the scouting opportunities lead him to, or the scouting work leads him to many opportunities to lead hunting, and he goes on quite a few buffalo hunts as sport. He once again gets into working for the Army in 1868, accompanies the groups he's with on many skirmishes with Indians and delivering dispatches between forts. He's been working on hunting for the railroad and all kinds of, to feed the railroad workers and all sorts of things in Kansas. The Nebraska map that we chose here is another, I think, useful way to look at his time period. This is Cram's railroad and township map of Nebraska from 1875. And we find Cody spending a lot of time in and around Fort McPherson. And this is where, of course, later this Nebraska will be the launching point for many of his more famous activities from the autobiography, like the Battle of Summit Springs or some early hunting expeditions and trading expeditions. He becomes a judge, a justice of the peace in North Platte and does some weddings, meets up with Professor Marsh from Yale, and of course the Sheridan hunting party that was recorded in 10 Days on the Plains, and then the Grand Duke Alexis party as well in 1872. He goes on many other hunts with people either out of North Platte or out of Omaha, so conveniently located on the rail, and finds himself eventually then in 1872, in December of that year, going on to the stage after Ned Buntline had met him in the late 60s and made him famous in Eastern circles with the serialized story of that became a dime novel. And so he starts to ply that trade on the boards, as it were. But then he comes back. So for this interesting period of time in the 1870s, he's an actual plainsman, and he's playing a plainsman on stage. Makes his permanent home at North Platte in May of 1878. Now, there's some themes that we're organizing a lot of that material I just ran through from these three different states, mostly Kansas and Nebraska, though. And these themes, we think, are going to help us better understand his experience. This is a fascinating promotional poster that is reproduced in full color at great expense in the Christensen edition of the autobiography that we just have out. And we're not really sure if it is something that the publisher made or was made later to tie into the autobiography, but it really seems to be a series of vignettes that are pulled right out of the pages of the autobiography, starting with him as a young man, as a teamster working with these wagon trains. There's his Pony Express time. He's hunting some beaver. There's the Justice of the Peace over here. There's the stagecoach. He's skirmishes with Indians, hunting buffalo, spying or scouting Indians here, where he's real being sneaky up there on the ledge. And then, of course, his duel with Yellow Hand and the first scalp for Custer. And then the meeting between he in the middle here and Sheridan and Alexis. So these are all things that happened before 1879 when the book comes out. Give us this real image of Buffalo Bill Plainsman, as opposed to that image you saw earlier, which had him meeting presidents and doing all these things in a almost, you know, laid on a national scale. This is on a very tight focus scale of that center iris here where we see the plains. And there's bison back there. There's a pony. There's a horse. There's some animal there that he's cutting his cooking on his thing there. He's got his accoutrement with his rifle and his lasso and his hat and all of that. So these themes that we've broken out are five. Transportation, military, Native Americans, bison, and boosterism, or town building. And we're keeping them pretty open, and we can fit lots of different things into them this way. But the transportation is quite evident, I think, from his time when he was 10 years old on, you know, the first job he had working with those wagon trains, and this time as a Pony Express rider or something similar. Stagecoach driving, this sort of thing. You could even think about putting, obviously the railroad fits into there as well. So these are themes that we find to help us research the context for the time and place that he claims to have been in. The military, of course, he was employed by the military as a civilian scout continuously from September of 1868 through November of 72. Providing some value, obviously, making an impression that he'll find works well for him later with the higher-ups that employed him, often coming back later as benefactors or even as evidence of his authenticity with the show. But these military forts were important. They were important, obviously, as nodes on a transportation route and connections to the development of town building and boosterism. So they're all sort of connected and they flow into each other in significant ways. But it's at these forts that Cody learned a lot about ambitions of the American Empire and its settlement. And of course, they connect directly to the Native American theme. As Native Americans gathered around forts in some cases, Cody would often go out on skirmishes against Native Americans, tribes with other tribes on his side. And so it's a really interesting, complex situation here. He is estimated to have taken part in 14 expeditions against Indians and 15 recorded fights. And this is at a time, Russell notes, that the average enlisted man took part in one during a whole five-year stint. So that's a lot. You know, he's having these frontline experiences that tells us something. But it's also during his time as a scout that he's getting more intimately associated with the land, with the flora, with the fauna, and with the plains ecosystem and environment altogether. The bison could be the next connection point there to that sort of ecosystem. An important part of the plains, not only environmentally but symbolically. He claims to have shot and killed 4,280, earning him the nickname Buffalo Bill during that 8-month contract he had with the Kansas Pacific Railroad, subline of the Union Pacific. It's important to note that this is before the wholesale slaughter of the hide hunting era. And all of those animals, unless one might have been a little gamey, were actually eaten by the workers. And so it's an interesting difference to make there between. I remember when I was teaching my first summer independent study class or summer reading class, and we used to sit in the union during lunchtime. They don't do this anymore. Maybe this is why. But I sit there with our books and syllabus, and students would walk by while they're getting lunch and look at what you have. And somebody came up to me and. It was a young woman who's from North Platte, and she goes, "I would love to take this class. I know nothing about Buffalo Bill, and he's everywhere." And I said, "Well, great, sign up." And then another woman comes by later and just puts her hand out on the fist. How can you teach something like this? Buffalo Bill was a criminal, and he did horrible things to the animals. And I was like, well, maybe you need to take the class, and we can figure something out. But there's interesting, just in one day sitting there, actually an hour, two different attitudes about this. And it's a lightning rod. But the celebrity hunts are a big part of this period, which is something he'll take up on later, that ties directly into the boosterism and town building. You know, far from the learning experience, let's chalk it up to experience that Rome represented, when he gets ready to develop Cody, Wyoming in the late 1890s, he's got a different plan, but he's also at a different time in his life. For a young man in his, you know, 20s to think he's going to become a town father and make a killing on real estate deals just if he can get the railroad to come through makes a lot of sense in that period. In the later part of the century, he's an older man now who feels that he's almost owed this by the federal government, a chance for him to go into almost a retirement with a legacy that would put him up. Still, though, he's seeking that recognition of a town father, a town builder, and that's something that, to some measure, he achieved with Cody, but it certainly didn't happen easily for him. So these themes help us to understand a little bit more about Cody's experiences that are represented in the autobiography, give us a chance to research, as I said, other materials from similar situations at the time to flesh those out. These are just some illustrations for each of the themes. These are from the autobiography or the programs. Which leads us to, and this is actually the plot for Rome, Kansas from 1867, which is really great. These themes then, these elements of his Great Plains experiences show up explicitly in both the, before I show this, in both the Buffalo Bill combination and the Wild West show. This is my last part I want to talk about anyway. But one of the things we've been working on is this spatial chronology of Cody's experience, and this is all of the Buffalo Bill combination performances. Somewhere I want to say it's around 1500 or something like that. But if we look at the first from 1872 to 1873, because he starts in December of 1872. This actually lops over two seasons. But as you can see, we modified this from the Willa Cather project that Andy Jewell and Zach Bajaber developed for the Cather Archive. My UCARE student has been working with Jason and I to develop this, and we will then, this will be part of the Cody Archive as soon as we're finished with it. We'll add also the Wild West performances in the U.S. and Europe, as well as some of his biographical points. But those will also be in the other project, as I mentioned. But you can see each performance during this period. So essentially, by the third show of his first tour, he's in Cincinnati, Ohio. You know, the place his parents left to go to Iowa, and he's gone through this entire experience on the plains, making himself into this authentic plainsman. And he's turning around and he's sharing that. He's, in many ways, he used to say he was educating the people about plains life. Now those first plays were certainly not aesthetically pleasing. They didn't offer a whole lot of high art. But in some ways, these lowbrow performances nevertheless introduced many Americans to an authentic Great Plains over the course of these 1,500-plus performances. Basically 14 years from 1872 to 1886, he took it to all these America's playhouses and theaters. And the Wild West exhibition, as we're very familiar with, and we could certainly spend another hour talking about that, is something that made an even larger impression on the American and European minds. The touring exhibition, Buffalo Bill's Wild West, was an extravaganza of bullets, bison, and action, which doesn't start with a B, that made its debut May 17th, 1883, in Omaha, Nebraska. So from out of the plains comes this entertainment spectacle on a large scale that was extremely successful. These events and their illustrated programs featured numerous activities that depicted these Great Plains themes, from stagecoaches and Pony Express riders and immigrant wagon trains and military drills to famous generals that Cody served under, Indian attacks on immigrant camps, stagecoaches, trains. They had races between Mexican cowboys, American cowboys, and Indians, Indian war dances and other depictions of culture. By 1895, the programs would also picked or contain advertising like this for his own canal project in Cody, Wyoming, that he founded in 1896. So millions of people experienced these Wild West performances from 1883 up until the end of his life. They experienced what Cody said was the real West. He never called it a show through these exhibitions, contributing significantly to the development of the mythic West that would be taken up later by novels and motion pictures and pulp fiction and radio and television, etc. Well, in conclusion, this transformation of the public conception of the Great Plains as a thrilling place filled with adventure and violence and action owes a lot to Cody's Wild West. And the centrality of the Great Plains to the Western experience and the national story had a champion in Cody. And his message was popular, being widely received from 1872 when he first stepped on stage to 1916 when he took his last bow. That's 44 years, and even longer if you consider the 100-plus imitation Wild West exhibitions that were spawned by his original that played to eager audiences until the 1940s. That's 75 years of Great Plains imagery in the popular consciousness, far from the Great American Desert label that appeared on influential maps, if not in the public mind. William F. Buffalo Bill Cody arrived on the scene just as a new concept. The Great Plains was being established by William Gilpin in 1857 and promoted by railroad companies after the Civil War years. This idea became the dominant image of the Western interior, it's said, by the early 1870s, an idea that was popularized by Buffalo Bill. So thank you. I appreciate your attention. This, of course, is the book I've been mentioning. That first one there is the project I was talking about, the Buffalo Bill's Great Plains, Cody Archive, and then the Buffalo Bill Project. So you're welcome to enjoy those. The first one, it's under development. The majority of the State Humanities Council grants don't expire till the end of the semester or the end of the summer, so check back often on Buffalo Bill's Great Plains.